This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 9 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
You bet, Steve. Well, we were going to be talking about gamma ray bursts, or GBRs. Now, that's a phenomenon from space which can really, really ruin your day. But we were going to try to take an approach that had some levity and common sense to it. But along the way, we started talking about the number of updates that we wanted to squeeze in before we turned our attention to gamma rays. And well, we got sidetracked, I think, Steve, and perhaps it's an interesting track to take. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what are we doing here today, Steve?
You know, Tim, as we've mentioned so many times before, it's a challenge not to find updates, but the challenge is to try to sift through so many and try to present something. We just have so many choices. Now, this may seem rather strange sounding to the average person on the street because mainstream media simply doesn't talk much about science. So for us on a weekly basis to say, oh man, we're having trouble trying to find something of interest, I thought that would be a topic that we could actually take a look at. What are our sources of information that perhaps most people don't have? And not only the sources that we get, but the kind of rabbit holes of interest that we go down. So that being said, Tim, how about if we let the audience in on what we hope is going to be a pleasant learning experience about our sources of space items?
I hope it is interesting to people too. I've been in and around the media for a long, long time. And of course, it's changed quite radically over the last 30, 40 years with the arrival of the internet, among other things, and consolidation in media, resulting in a real transformation of the landscape. We, of course, are all familiar with Google searches, but somewhere along the line, YouTube videos came into play and have become the most popular form of search engine, certainly among young people. And I don't know if you've noticed it, Steve, but quite often you'll find when you're looking for something in a search that there's some unknown dude in a garage somewhere explaining to you how you're going to fix something or do something or unpack something or put a product together. And these are individuals that are locked away in corners and all over the planet. And you come across them and sometimes they're incredibly helpful. And I wanted to mention at the start that, well, you know, why is that going on? Why are all those people being so kind to us? And the answer is, of course, money. And the way it works is rather bizarre. And I've actually known a friend of mine who was into this more than 20 years ago. So you put a video online, a YouTube video, and you're hoping that you can attract eyeballs. And if you do attract people with eyeballs looking at your video, well, then advertisers come along and say, well, just who is it that's watching your YouTube videos? And they can do a little bit of an analysis, figure out who it is and say, you know what, that's the very group of people I'm trying to reach by selling this other product. And they give a very, very small amount of money to these individuals for the number of small number of people that tend to be watching them. But here's the sort of scale thing. All the big players are really no different. The BBC, the CBC, NBC, CNN, they're all out there trying to do the very same thing, attract eyeballs, attract people that they can then monetize by saying to advertisers, here are the people who tune into this show. How would you like to reach them by advertising in our channel? And so this has changed the sources of information from conglomerates or major news agencies to the guy next door who's explaining, you know, how to fry an egg. It's one of the very big differences in the landscape of finding answers to questions you might have. Steve, you must have experienced this yourself. Who hasn't?
Well, exactly. And that's where we get into the rabbit hole of things. We may come across something in mainstream media, we'll give them that. And the topic might be, oh, let's just say Chinese taikonauts on way to space station. So you do a little research into that, and then you'll find someone such as Scott Manley, who has degrees in science, and he explains all kinds of interesting things, such as rockets, how they launch, and how the taikonauts are making their rendezvous, and so on and so forth. These are people, of course, that we never heard of before. If we go back decades and decades, Tim, that you and I would have come across would be, if you're taking a university course, it was almost mandatory that the lecturing prof would have on his reading list a text which he had just published. And of course, he'd be referencing that. So you had to shell out $30, which was a hefty sum of money in those days. And nowadays, we don't have to do that. You a little bit of searching on the internet, and you can come across, as you said, shall we call them individual science or citizen scientists who are presenting material. And you can very quickly wean out those which are simply culling and collecting materials from others, and they're not presenting anything new. And those which are just far out and not worthy of paying any attention to.
But that gets us, Steve, into the critical thinking part of the challenge. And I do recall this professor I had way, way back in history gave us a first assignment, year one of university. Professor Sydenham said, you've got to write a paper on the origin of World War One. And he said, I don't expect you to give me the answer. I expect you to use your researching skills to come up with a credible thesis and therefore discern the good books, the worthy analysis that you're going to draw upon. And that's in a very much the way we are facing the challenge now, is in the myriad of these incredible number of people who've got their own YouTube channels, the rabbit holes that take us into weird corners. We have to learn to set aside those. So you think, you know, that's a little bit too obtuse, or I'm not quite sure I buy that. It's not like watching Peter Mansbridge explain the news of the day to you 20 years ago, or you know, Knowlton Nash, or whomever was your favorite. Nowadays, you can't really be as sure of the source of information because there's so many of whom you may never see more than once. Now, I think you mentioned this fellow, Scott. You tend to go back to him because you've decided after a certain amount of time and experience that he's delivering some pretty useful information. Isn't that the case?
Well, it is. And then, of course, as a discerning listener, as I'm sure many of our listeners are, you want to check out this fellow. So you do a search on Wikipedia. And while I'm mentioning Wikipedia, I found the shortcut is you don't have to type out the whole word Wikipedia, just type in Wiki. So, for instance, if we wanted to find some information about Scott Manley, just type in your search engine, Scott Manley Wiki. And then it brings up Wikipedia. And then you can check that out. And then typically there'll be a list of references under that. And you can check the references of the references. And very quickly you can see whether these are viable or they're not. And from that you can determine whether indeed they were a graduate or are they making something up from a paper university.
Well, I want to bridge then from Wikipedia, which I can't imagine anybody has not explored at least once or twice, to the arrival of the artificial intelligence searches that we can do now. It's been some time since you and I discovered the magic of using ChatGPT, which is one of the first and most famous of these freely available AI services online. And of course, even in the last couple of years, they've become far more sophisticated and competent. Now, one of their limitations is they tend to acquire a database that becomes static. And at the beginning of ChatGPT, I sort of recall a date of something like February 2020. If it happened before that, well, it was in their database. And if it happened after that, well, it just wasn't. But if you were looking for information on things that happened earlier than the start date or whatever, the end date, well, it was amazing what you could do. And you could ask it for questions. I'll give you an example. We'll pull up the veil. We'd do an episode on, say, Neptune. And you could say, give me 10 interesting facts about Neptune. Well, you'd get 10 interesting facts, and it would be headlines. And you'd then go down different rabbit holes to research those and find out how accurate those 10 interesting things were and how we might cobble them together to make a show about Neptune. And that's one example. You don't rely on everything you read there, nor should you rely on everything you read in any particular news source. But you apply some critical thinking and hope for the best, and do the best you can to make sure you're not rebroadcasting nonsense.
Just before we leave Wikipedia, I do have one particular reference that I think points out the value of it before I want to talk about AI. For instance, I did decades ago take a course in astrophysics, and we found out about Wolf-Rayet stars. That's Wolf hyphen Rayet. And I know that most people have never even heard of that. So I wanted to go to Wikipedia and see what it had to say. I was totally surprised. There were literally 17 pages of information about Wolf-Rayet stars. And then you get to the bottom of that, and then there were about 4 pages of references. And you can tell the references because they're in italics and they're blued because they're all hyperlinks. So I clicked on any number of them, and it was quite amazing to see that the link that they had were high academic in nature. We were going to universities, we were going to observatories, and these are well-renowned one. As a matter of fact, there were 105 references and hyperlinks to the original sources. So Wikipedia can be very valuable. It's a starting point, and it's citizen-based in the sense that people can go in and edit it, and that can be a very big downfall. Particularly if you're looking up social media stuff. Can imagine if you looked up a politician and you said politician X downfalls, and then you could find information there. But those people then can put in false information, but they're very quickly edited out by people who monitor it.
Steve, I think it's important to say that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that in the case of mainstream media such as the Globe and Mail or the New York Times or CBC News or CTV News, these people have dedicated players, agents, lawyers, researchers. They actually have to, legally, they have to take the care to make sure that they either correct their mistakes or avoid mistakes. And that is not the case for almost any of the online news sources that you'll find. You can't sue Wikipedia for giving you bad information, but you can sue a newspaper such as the Globe for cases of defamation or misinformation, or insist upon and get a retraction. So this is a continuing advantage of reliability that you get with larger mainstream media that is too often dismissed as being lamestream or inaccurate. Not that it doesn't have its faults, Steve, but we should just keep that in mind along the way.
Well, that was a good point. I really wasn't aware of that. With regard to artificial intelligence, yes, both you and I started off using ChatGPT at about the same time. Recently, I've been starting to do Microsoft's Copilot. And what I have found when you first start it up, it wants to know your name. So you type in your name, and then it gives you a choice of voices that it will speak to you. And it's okay, you choose a voice which you find pleasing. And then you can find out that you can modify the sophistication of your answers. For instance, if you were to type in something of what's the composition or what is the regolith like on the lunar surface? And the answer might come back, it's dusty. And then you can say, that's not sufficient. I want technical answers. And then it ups its game. Whereas ChatGPT, when at least the versions that I've been using to this point, which I think are version 3, ChatGPT came out and gave you what it had. It didn't have its own filter. So that's something which I'm learning about. I don't know if you've experienced that.
I actually have gone the other way with ChatGPT, where I've given it a question and received its answer, and then said, simplify this for an audience of high school students, or simplify this for a radio show, or in other words, have it condensed and simplified. And I found that to be quite useful. Sometimes the science that it delivers may or may not be accurate, but it's already over my head, and I'm wanting to double check to make sure I'm understanding what it's saying.
I know exactly what you mean.
Steve, we're going to spend some time in the second half of this show about our sources, talking about some of the YouTube stars and other reliable sources that you discovered and are using, a little bit about my own. And then, of course, we're going to actually get to some of the updates that started us down this discussion today. And there were so many. So, Steve, tell me about somebody that you've turned to for interesting nuggets.
Well, in no particular chronological order, I quickly came to appreciate the likes of Dr. Don Lincoln, and he conducts experiments at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Chicago, and he himself is a particle physicist. And just this year, he received a very special award for, quote, a passionate and profound career-long impact in sharing excitement of contemporary physics and so on. He's a self-deprecating gentleman who always presents in front of a chalkboard with interesting equations and such on the background, but he has animations and so on. So Dr. Lincoln, it was just a gem for me to find. Another one, which I've recently come across, is Anton Petrov, and he invariably interacts with his audience with a "Hello, wonderful person." That always makes you feel good. And he presents very, very up-to-date animations and explanations of new discoveries in space and astrophysics, particularly cosmology and space exploration. So Anton Petrov is an amazing person. And we did mention Scott Manley. I just found out that he has an asteroid named after him. It's called Asteroid 33434 Scott Manley. And the reason is because he got his master's degree in training as an astrophysicist and created visualizations of the asteroid belt. So kudos to him. If you really want to go into interesting and esoteric things, you cannot go wrong with Dr. Sean Carroll, who has obtained a doctorate degree in astronomy. And he's also a theoretical physicist and philosopher. And he specializes in quantum mechanics, cosmology, and the philosophy of science. He has all kinds of YouTube presentations, which I'm sure many of our people will find very, very interested. He's also likes working on the arrow of time problem, like why does time only go in one direction? Why can we not go backwards? He's been working with Jennifer Chen, and he's positing that the Big Bang is not a unique occurrence, but rather one of many cosmic inflation events which resulted from quantum fluctuations of vacuum energy. And so those kinds of things like vacuum energy are phrases that I'll hone in on and then do a research on, and down the rabbit hole we go.
I want to commend you on the Sean Carroll mention. I came across his book some years ago. It's called The Big Picture. And I don't know, it is one of my absolute favorites. He, of course, as you said, he's a brilliant man, but he's one of those rare scientists we come across who has an extraordinary ability to say, now, how can I tell this story in a way that that guy in Salmon Arm and that other feller in Brentwood Bay can understand? He's extraordinary. So I double down on the Sean Carroll source.
I just saw him being interviewed the other day, and they got to a particular part in the discussion, and Sean turns to the interviewer and he says, "To what level now do you want me to speak? What's the level of your audience?" And he said, "Well, they're pretty sophisticated." So bang, he takes the sophisticated route, but you know very well that there was a much easier route, and I'm not going to say dumbed down, but perhaps explained with more detail and slowly for those who are not familiar with such things. So, yes, as you say, he's a gem.
Now, I guess I should mention that your means of getting to the nuggets that you like and use is somewhat different than my own. And it's not that there's a right or a wrong. It's interesting that what we're talking about is how you can develop a media digest, a menu of sources of information that work for you. And I use different browsers and Firefox, Google, Chrome, and so on. And what I've discovered is that they develop their own algorithms to understand the kinds of things I'm interested in and search. So on any given day when I open those browsers up, there's a menu of stories, and those are really good jumping off points for me. I might get 10 of those a day pop up, and if I have the time, I might go down them and say, I'll check out the first story, the one that's got my eye, and if I like it, well, then I'll pursue it somewhere else. And so that's a different way of skimming the tides to come across the occasional wave that you want to ride. But we wouldn't be doing this show today, this discussion, if it weren't for the fact that we were looking for some updates, as we always do, and are always struck by the number of choices that we have. And this week is no different. And why don't we sort of end the show by saying, hey, look, here's some of the headlines that we don't have time to talk about in great detail, but it gives you a demonstration of the breadth of news in this field. So, Steve, take it away. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, I don't know, Dr. Brian Keating?
A little more personable, shall we say, than Dr. Leonard Susskind, who, if you want to know something about science and string theory and so on, Leonard Susskind is the person to go to. Arvin Ashe is another YouTube presenter who will explain things in a manner which are perhaps easier to understand than the way Leonard Susskind will. Fraser Cain, Cain, has an almost daily update on articles with animation. So those are some individuals. And who could forget Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder, who's a physicist out of Germany. These people are some key ones that I search out for, but also I've come across some great websites such as The Space Race, Curious Droid, The Science Asylum, Everyday Astronauts, Hard Science Explained, Space Flight Now, and The Secrets of the Universe. And each of those has a presenter that, or a viewpoint, which I'm sure that many of our listeners would like. But as you said, Tim, when we started this originally, episode 9, it was going to be about gamma ray bursts. And we tried to take a look at the most recent things in 1 week. Well, there were too many. So you and I skimmed it down to what, as of the day of scripting, what were the items, the breaking news items just in the last 3 days? And it's unbelievable. From Dr. Brian Keating, he comes up with, is Earth truly one of a kind? So let's go exploring exoplanets. Wow, okay, so there's a little rabbit hole you could go down to. And another one from Curious Droid, how big really is the universe? And of course, when you go down that, you realize there's at least three universes in the sense that there's the universe that we can see, the universe that we can never see because light is the universe is expanding faster than the light, which is being propagated, and then the universe which existed before light could be propagated. So that's interesting. Tim, you've got a couple of updates
Sure,
that.
I do. There's an interview that was recently done with the commander of the Polaris Dawn mission, which had that elliptical orbit taking commercial private citizen astronauts really into a high orbit around and into a dangerous place. They were experimenting with new spacesuits. They were doing spacewalks. There was no NASA captain in charge of things. So that was an interesting interview. There was a story about the Shenzhou space station, the Chinese space station, number 19, getting a new crew. I think the crew is sort of the 19th crew, if I understand the nomenclature there. But you get footage of these Chinese taikonauts arriving at the space station. And, a lot of people might say, I didn't even know they had one. Well, they're in business on a regular basis. And nowadays you can watch the coming and going of that. Steve, your turn.
And speaking of the taikonauts, the crew that came back just landed this morning. And so, I mean, if you want to go down a rabbit hole, what are their names? What are their ages? And I think you'd be surprised that the ones that are currently in space are their youngest cadre of taikonauts. Science News talks about the Chinese Long March launch escape system. I didn't even know they had one. Fermilab. Dr. Lincoln is doing a dark matter question and answer session. So that would be interesting. Tim, you got one from the space race, I think.
Let's see here. I've got the space race down here. Elon Musk is talking about his Starship Flight 6, which is coming up. And that'll be happening probably next spring. And it's an important step that they announced they'll be taking in that next mission, which would allow them to transfer fuel from one spacecraft to another. This is an essential ingredient in terms of the mission to Mars. And I wanted to build on that with a number of other stories here that have come up. We had a story that I really wanted to talk about, which is the troubles at Axiom with their space station. It ties into what we were mentioning last week when we were talking about how the number of companies providing services to NASA and the Space Force is dwindling. First of all, there was a flurry of new companies like Axiom getting into the commercial business, but they don't all succeed. Axiom was to build the next new space station. Well, Axiom is basically going broke. They've had nothing but trouble for the last 4 years, and I hadn't actually been paying attention, but had not been following the money, which of course is a mistake. And so then you've got Elon Musk also trying to make sure that ULA, his competitor for the military contracts, that they're going to also be up against the wall, and they're in the news for a similar kind of failure to make money, failure to deliver a product in space. It's a very different situation when you have so many companies, either visibly or not so visibly, trying to get a piece of the action. And a great many of them, they talk the promise, but they don't walk.
That's right. And that last one you mentioned, if you go to the website Space Trends, their headline in the last couple of days is How SpaceX is Destroying ULA, Making Them Bankrupt.
Also in Space Trends, you've got Boeing reportedly, now we haven't heard this from the company itself, giving up on its Starliner and planning to sell it and other components of its space program. Not every single component, but just examples in the news of these financial problems that have huge ramifications.
Can we say that you heard it here first?
Of course you can.
Okay. Anton Petrov, just in the last couple of days, has come up with and discusses major discoveries about Earth's magnetosphere, and also a study that confirms that there are water-rich exoplanets, exoplanets containing more water than our planet. Well, that's pretty amazing. And he's got another one, the headline being Most Powerful Gamma Rays in Our Galaxy Are Coming from an Unknown Source. And of course, if that doesn't have 1950 science fiction movie title written all over it, I don't know what does.
How about black hole jets, Steve? That's there's two of them. They're it was discovered at the Kiko Observatory, and these are jets pluming out into space from near a black hole that is an enormously long distance from Earth. I've forgotten the number, but it would be, you know, say, how long is this plume of light? It's the equivalent of lining up 140 Milky Ways in a row. So you've got, you know, whatever is causing this light, it's a long way away from us, so we don't have to worry about it torching our little planet. But it's an extraordinary phenomenon which they say they don't really understand. They can see it, but they don't know what's actually caused it.
You know, the underlying thing which all amazes me about all of this, all of these things that are occurring in space are inanimate in a sense, they're non-living. And yet you have these non-living entities creating gamma ray bursts or ripping stars apart. It's just amazing. And but what could amaze me more than Arvin Ashe's update, Does a copy of you exist in the multiverse? There
You
is a
see?
theory that every time you make a decision to pick up the pen with your right hand instead of hitting it on the floor, that it does hit the floor in an alternate universe.
Saying is, in some universe, the Toronto Maple Leafs may have won a Stanley Cup.
Dear listeners, it's a pause for laughter.
There's just some things that are not credible, Steve.
That's right. That ends that one.
But listen, I think we've probably done a great job of at least explaining what we've been up to in the last few years when we're trying to understand where to turn to for interesting information about what's going on in space.
Well, you're so right about that, Tim. And once again, our biggest challenge each week is not trying to find what to present, but what not to present, shall we say.
I'm afraid this is all the time we have for this episode of Space Talk. So this is Tim Woods in Brentwood Bay.
Stephen Lowry here in Salmon Arms saying so long, and we'll see you next time on.
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?